Your Financial Choices may discuss various financial-related topics and thus would like to offer the following disclosures. Lori Siebert is employed by Valley National Group, the Valley National Financial Advisors Group of Companies. Investments are offered through Valley National Investments Incorporated, member FINRA. We inform you that any federal tax, state tax, financial advice, or information contained in this communication is not intended to be personalized or specific in nature, or to be relied upon for your personal situation in any circumstance. The advice and information are not intended and cannot be used as a tax opinion letter, nor used for the purpose of avoiding tax-related penalties. For personalized advice specific to your own situation, we recommend that you consult your CPA, CFP, or attorney.
Good evening, everyone, and welcome to the show. This is your host, Lori Siebert. I'm a CPA, CFP, and AEP on the web at yourfinancialchoices.com. I'd like to remind everyone that you can listen online as well at wdiy.org. And that's especially important for those who enjoy the show and may have family or relatives who are outside of our listening area. They can just jump online at the website, listen, stream live while we're on air, or if they don't have the opportunity to listen in our local area or listen live, or it might not just be the right time, podcasts are on the website as well. So at wdiy.org, and we also have the podcast links through yourfinancialchoices.com. If there is a topic, perhaps a financially related topic you're not sure about, that maybe you want some information, you can go jump around these website, the links for the shows to see if there's a topic that might we might have covered that will help you. So those are available on wdiy.org or yourfinancialchoices.com. And I believe on WDIY, you go to local programming and look for the show and then find the links, and they have the topics. So maybe there's one about estate planning or insurance or financial planning, cash flow, all the different topics we have each week. So letting you know that's out there. Today is December 7th, 2016. The markets were up today, the Dow closing at all-time highs, 19,549, the NASDAQ at 5393, and the S&P at 2073. And I happened to pull some notes from last year's tax year-end show, and the market at that time, year-end December of 2015, the Dow closed at 17,749. That was, I think, about a 10% adjustment there since a year ago. And the NASDAQ was at 5071 versus 5393, and the S&P was 2241 versus, no, maybe I mixed that up. It was 2241, and maybe a year ago it was 2073. So we're like 8 to 10% up from a year ago on those indicators. So just thought that was kind of fun to look at. What are we talking about tonight? We're talking about year-end planning. What do you need to do? What ideas might we have out there? What can you still do? What do we have time to still do some tax planning at December 7th? And you're going to find out there are still some things we can talk about. We are live tonight. We will take your questions. Lori's in the studio with me this evening, and we'll answer the calls, take your information, and we ask you to mute your radio so you can hear me without the delay and we can talk without confusion. We do discuss general financial planning topics and not specific investments. And while I typically have a topic each week, you can still ask questions off topic, and I will do my best to answer them. The number this evening is 610-758-8810. Let me repeat that, 610-758-8810. And you can talk live on air, or if you're not comfortable talking live on air, you can give your question to Lori. She'll jot it down, and she'll bring it into the studio. Email is also available at yourfinancialchoices.com. So some of the things we're going to be talking about tonight, one, capital losses, harvesting capital losses. I'll talk with that. Talk about what that means. 529 accounts as it pertains to Pennsylvania, education credits, IRAs. kind of just some tax planning strategies around business income and deductions, Schedule A deductions. So we will get started. Let me tell you what harvesting capital losses is about. What that means is when you have your income for the year, some of it is predictable. It might be your wages, pension, or Social Security. Sometimes our income isn't as predictable. It might be that we have received capital gain distributions from mutual funds. Maybe we sold some investments in our non-retirement accounts, and we might have big capital gains. Sometimes what we have to think about is, in that case, though, are the realized gains. So it's things that we've sold. Those, we know what they are. What is sometimes not predictable is the capital gain distributions from mutual funds that we might have. Sometimes the mutual fund manager is buying and selling during the year. They may sell, you know, quite a bit of their positions and in the last month of the year. And we won't always know what those capital gain distributions might be. They will estimate them in some respects for some of these funds, and we may have that information, you know, in the next couple weeks. So one of the things we might want to look for in our portfolios, in our non-retirement accounts, are positions where we might have a loss and we could realize that loss. We could sell that position and take that loss to help offset some of those gains that we may already have realized, or those capital gain distributions from the mutual fund companies. Now, when we take a loss, we call that harvesting losses at the end of the year. It doesn't necessarily mean we don't like that position that we had the loss in. If you think about it, when we do asset allocation, you are broadly diversified, and not all of the positions in your accounts will act the same way. So not all of them are going to go up at the same time. Not all of them are going to go down at the same time. You hope that they will not be correlated such that you have a diversified portfolio. So there might be times when there's certain positions that are up and there might be some that are down, and it meets your investment objective. It might be an asset class that you want, but just right now it could be down. Maybe it goes up in January. Maybe it's cyclical. So it might be that you don't really want to get rid of it completely. So what we talk about when we say harvesting losses, it's not necessarily just a once and done thing. When we sell something to take a loss, to realize a loss for tax planning purposes, we might want to go back into that position. But the IRS has something called the wash sale rules, and they don't want you to go back into it the next day. So don't get clever and think, oh, I'm going to take this $3,000 loss on this position, but I like it, and I'm going to buy it back tomorrow at a lower price. They call that a wash sale. And the wash sale rules say if you can't buy back the same position you just took a loss in within 30 days, you have to wait 31 days. And you also cannot do it in a different account. So you might think, okay, I'll do this in account A, I'll sell it in account A, and I'll buy it back in account B. No, the IRS looks across all of your accounts. So you want to either put it on your calendar to buy it back in 31 days, if that still makes sense, or you can buy something of a similar, in a similar asset class. So maybe there's another mutual fund that acts just like this one. They don't care if you go into a different fund. All right. So that is avoiding the wash sale rules, and it's harvesting losses. So that is when you want to stay in that kind of position. You may not want that again. Maybe it's part of rebalancing your portfolio. You see an opportunity to take this loss. Maybe you don't want to be in that asset class anymore, and you decide to sell it and just not go back into that particular asset class. Maybe you decide to hold it in cash. Maybe you decide to go a totally different direction with it. Maybe you decide to take a distribution. You sell something, take the loss, and maybe you want to use the money for cash flow purposes. So there's a few things you can do with it. You just want to be careful of the little hiccups when you hear about people harvesting losses. Make sure you understand all the ramifications of what you do to get back into the market, et cetera. So when we harvest those losses, it's going to help offset some of our gains. When we come back from our break, I'm going to tell you there might be times where you don't want to harvest losses. If you have questions, the phone number is 610-758-8810. We'll be back in a minute.
WDIY thanks its members and Valley National Financial Advisors, offering a broad spectrum of financial services for more than 25 years, including fee-based asset management. It all starts with personal goals and an understanding of risk tolerance, investment objectives, and the markets. On the web at valleynationalgroup.com or 610-868-9000.
WDIY's fourth annual December Pledge Drive will begin on Monday, December 12th. As we enter the holiday giving season, please consider renewing your WDIY membership, making an additional gift, or becoming a first-time member. Your donation to WDIY is tax-deductible. Make your donation today at WDIY.org. Thank you for your support.
Welcome back to the show. This is your host, Lori Siebert. You're listening to Your Financial Choices. We're talking about year-end tax planning to the extent we can still do some tax planning. And yes, we can. There are some opportunities still out there. If you have questions, the phone number is 610-758-8810, 610-758-8810. And you can ask questions live on air or off air if you're not comfortable talking live. And you will give those questions to Lori. She'll jot those down and bring them into the studio. And I'll do my best to answer them. So we were just talking about tax loss harvesting and a few of the cautions around it. And one thing I also want to mention before I tell you when it might not make sense to harvest losses, I also want to mention, if you were listening carefully, you heard me say non-retirement accounts, not retirement accounts, because I have had where people think what happens in their IRA accounts count toward gains and losses. And I want to stress that that is not the case. What happens with an IRA, when you realize gains or realize losses, it's just all within the IRA. And it doesn't mean that you have any tax consequences of that. When you have tax consequences from IRAs is when you make a distribution out of them. So don't worry about if you have realized gains in an IRA, because, I mean, that's great if you have realized gains, but it's not going to be an income tax consequence to you until you take some distributions out. And then when you take out a $5,000 distribution out of an IRA, it's a $5,000 taxable, unless you have basis in the IRA, which isn't that often, or if it's a Roth. Okay, so just keep that in mind. When I'm talking about harvesting losses, I'm talking about taking them in non-retirement accounts. Sometimes you'll hear people call those non-qualified accounts. It might be your joint account. It might be an individual account. All right, it's just not an IRA account. So when might you not want to harvest losses? Well, I might hesitate to harvest loss. It's not that I wouldn't, but I might hesitate to harvest losses if you're in a zero tax bracket. Recall that if you're in a 15% tax bracket and have capital gains, they're taxed at zero. So I would probably rather save losses for individuals when they're going to be in higher tax brackets. I wouldn't want to waste my capital losses in a 15% tax bracket, or if you're going to be having zero. So get some extra income on your return if you want to do that. You could play tax brackets if you think it's a good time to take losses. Maybe it's also a good time to do some IRA conversions to Roth. So these are the kinds of income tax planning strategies you might want to look at year end. Does it make sense to take those losses or not, or might there be other reasons to do so? But typically when we're talking about harvesting losses, we're talking about folks who have either large capital gains, maybe for people who are in the top tax bracket who might be subject to the 20% capital gains rate, or people who are making over $250,000 if you're married filing joint, or $200,000 if you're single, and you might be subject to the Medicare net investment income tax, that surtax, the net investment income tax, which is 3.8% for the people over those thresholds on their investment income. So by harvesting some losses, you are lowering that amount of investment income that might be subject to not only the income tax subject to those gains, but the net investment income surtax of 3.8%. All right. So something to think about for people who are in the higher income. Might it be time to harvest some losses? I have to tell you, I was looking at some accounts today for clients looking to see if we could harvest some losses, and there weren't losses. So you want to kind of keep an eye on that. There may be times and years when you might want to harvest losses, even when you think you might not need them today, if you can carry them forward to future years. And that is something you want to watch out for when you think about the gains that you have. When you're looking at tax planning strategies for year end, and I'm talking about harvesting losses, you might say to yourself, oh, I had a big gain this year. I had a $20,000 capital gain. I need to harvest some losses. Well, you can't do that in a vacuum. You have to pull out your last year's tax return, your 2015 tax return, and look to see what was on that tax return, because you might actually have had capital losses in prior years that you didn't use up, that carry forward into the current year. So you may or may not need to harvest losses. You may still want to harvest more because you can continue to carry them forward. Let me tell you how that works, because some people don't understand that either. Capital losses will first offset capital gains within their own category. So we have something called short-term and long-term. So short-term losses will first offset short-term gains. Long-term losses will first offset long-term gains. To the extent they exceed that category, they can then offset the other category of income. So if I had $5,000 of short-term capital gain on my return, and I have long-term capital gains on my return. So short-term capital gains of, let's say, $5,000, and long-term capital gains of $10,000. And I decide to generate some losses. I'm going to harvest some losses. And I find $12,000 of long-term capital losses that I can harvest in my portfolio. And I take them. That's $12,000. And I'm thinking, that's great. I'm going to offset this capital gain income I have. $5,000 of short-term, $10,000 of long-term. That's $15,000 of gains I want to offset. Gosh, if I got to pick where I offset it first, I would want to offset the short-term first, because that is subject to ordinary income tax rates, which could be much higher than long-term rates. So in my mind, I might think, oh, good, I'm going to take these losses. I'm going to offset the short-term and then the long-term. No. It offsets its own category of income first. So if I have $12,000 of long-term losses, it will first offset that $10,000 of long-term gains. I have $2,000 left of long-term losses after I do that offset in that category. Now I can use it toward my short-term gain. So that extra $2,000 of long-term losses can offset my short-term, and in the end, that nets out to a $3,000 short-term capital gain. Now, if I had $18,000 of long-term losses, it would offset the first 10 of long-term, offset the next 5 of short-term. I've used 15 of that 18, and I have an extra $3,000 of loss. The IRS will let us use an extra $3,000 of loss that we have against ordinary income on page one. And that is the best, because we get to use a $3,000 capital loss against ordinary income. And that is great. So, well, if you have to have losses, it's a great thing to do. It's always great to have gains. But if we can do some of this harvesting, it helps sometimes to offset some of that ordinary income. In doing that, we've reduced our capital gain income. And not only have we reduced our capital gain income, but we also reduced $3,000 of ordinary income. In this case, if I were able to harvest losses, I technically just took $18,000 off page one of my tax return, lowering my income by that much. That could open me up to not only saving income taxes, but it might help with limitations on Schedule A itemized deductions. It might help lower my income to allow other kinds of deductions or tax credits, etc. You want to always run the numbers through your tax software to see the implications of the decisions that you've made and how they kind of filter through the whole tax return. All right, so that is harvesting losses and when you might not want to harvest losses if you're in a really low tax bracket. Okay, folks, when we come back, we'll continue our discussion about year-end tax planning. If you have questions, I'm happy to answer them. The phone number is 610-758-8810. Back in a minute.
WDIY thanks its members and Valley National Financial Advisors, offering a broad spectrum of financial services for more than 25 years, including income tax preparation for individuals, businesses, estates, and trusts. Tax preparation involves more than putting numbers on a return. It requires planning. On the web at valleynationalgroup.com or 610-868-9000.
Spread the word about your organization or business to a well-informed audience. Become an underwriter with WDIY. Our lineup of NPR news and locally produced music programs reaches thousands of locally engaged listeners each day. Underwriting on WDIY is an affordable way to enhance your image and to provide information about your services to people who care. To learn more about underwriting opportunities, call 610-694-8100, extension 6, or visit our website, wdiy.org.
Welcome back to the show. You're listening to Your Financial Choices. This is your host, Lori Siebert. The phone number this evening is 610-758-8810, 610-758-8810. I am wondering if people could be out doing their holiday shopping already.
Yeah.
And if you are, you might want to think about listening to Your Financial Choices instead for all these tax-saving strategies. And I will also tell you, be practical. Don't buy what people don't need. Make donations instead this year. In fact, I was thinking about that. I thought, you know, what really do my children need at this point? And I had the idea of making a charitable contribution, donation, or I'm involved in doing some wish list for needy families. And I thought, what a great idea to fulfill a wish list for a needy family and put that as a present for my children under the tree with a, it would just be the note, not the items, a note saying, a needy family was taken care of in your name, kind of a thing. So I had that thought, and maybe we all need to think about doing that a little bit more as well. Sharing or scattering kindness, as a client said to me, scattering kindness. So we're talking about year-end tax planning strategies. If you would like to ask questions, we're here live. You can ask questions live, or if you're not comfortable talking live on air, you can just give your question to Lori. The phone number is 610-758-8810. And when I say Lori, it's L-O-R-I, and I am L-A-U-R-I-E. So in my mind, when I say our names, they're different. But you, the listener, hears them, and they are sounding the same, but we are two different people sitting here in the studio. So if you call in, it's L-O-R-I that you're going to be talking to. If you want to talk live, you'll be talking to me, L-A-U-R-I-E. Again, 610-758-8810. Let me mention one other thing about harvesting losses and capital losses. And you heard me mention capital loss carry forwards. I want to finish what I was saying. The capital losses can first offset their own category of income. Then they can offset any remaining capital gains in the other category. Then you can do $3,000 of loss on page one against ordinary income. If you have capital losses that exceed that $3,000, they carry forward indefinitely until you use them up under that same scenario I just described. that is awesome. They carry forward indefinitely until you use it up. That is for federal purposes. Do not be confused with Pennsylvania. Pennsylvania does not allow capital loss carry forward. So that might be another reason why you might want to think, is it worth taking these losses if it's going to possibly mess you up for Pennsylvania because you're not going to get to carry them forward. So, you know, my example of sometimes you want to take losses when you have them because maybe next year you're not going to have them. Well, you just want to kind of think that all through before you make a final decision, but keep that in mind. Let me talk about 529 accounts for a minute. Year end, one of the things we can also still do and save some taxes is to fund an education account called a 529 account. When we are Pennsylvania residents, we get a deduction for contributions to a 529 account, and we don't even have to be the owner. But what we do have to do is make a direct contribution to that 529 account. The other little hiccup with that is you also have to have the name of the beneficiary on the 529 and their Social Security number. So I could make a contribution to my nephew's 529 account and get a deduction for it on my Pennsylvania return, but I have to have his name and Social Security number. The other item of importance is that there are limitations on this deduction for Pennsylvania. The first limitation is it cannot exceed $14,000 per donor or donee. So I could do $14,000 to my nephew. My husband could do $14,000 to my nephew. I could do $14,000 to my niece. And my husband could do $14,000 to the niece. So in that scenario, we could give $56,000 total to a niece and a nephew. As long as I have their name, their Social Security number, and I write the check directly to the 529 account. The other limitation, though, is that we also have to have income each. So if I had no income on my return and my husband had wages of $56,000 and he did $28,000 and I did $28,000, we would only be able to deduct $28,000 because I don't have earnings and my contributions then aren't going to be deductible. It's still a nice thing to do. It's still a great tax saving vehicle for qualified education expenses. We're just not going to get a deduction in full for that. You have to have income. So in my little scenario, if my husband made $56,000 and maybe I had $5,000 of interest income, I could at least deduct up to the amount of income that I had in my name. So that's a nice deduction. And quite often people will say, does it have to be a Pennsylvania plan? No, it does not. So it could be a 529 education savings account anywhere in the country. That is a great incentive for funding education costs and for encouraging our children to attend higher education because they will have more funds available to pay for their college. So it's a great vehicle to save money for college because it's tax-free income and growth on that account as long as we use the money for qualified education expenses. All right. And there are different definitions for qualified education expenses for a myriad of education kind of credits and deductions and eligible programs. So we want to make sure that we understand what the qualified education deductions or expenses are for each of the different vehicles that might be available. And what I'm talking about is there's also distributions out of 529 accounts that qualify for that tax-free treatment. But then the IRS isn't going to let us double dip and also get another kind of education credit or deduction or benefit if we're already getting a benefit of tax-free earnings and growth on our 529. We call it a coordination of benefits. And people need to understand that, but there still might be time before the end of the year to take advantage of some education credits that are out there or deductions. So when we come back from our next break, I'll talk about what those are and what to watch out for and what you can still do before year end. We still have a few weeks. The phone number is 610-758-8810, 610-758-8810. And you're listening to Your Financial Choices, and we come back, we will continue our discussion.
WDIY thanks its members and Valley National Financial Advisors, offering a broad spectrum of financial services for more than 25 years, including estate planning and tax preparation, especially for Pennsylvania and New Jersey residents subject to state inheritance tax reporting. On the web at valleynationalgroup.com or 610-868-9000.
And you are listening to WDIY, Lehigh Valley's community NPR station, your source for NPR news, public affairs, and a great mix of hand-picked music. Lehigh Valley weather, current conditions, 42 degrees under fair skies tonight, cloudy, lows around 30. Thursday, clearing late in the day, highs around 42. Friday and Saturday, sunny skies with highs each day in the upper 30s. And Sunday, chance of a rain-snow mix with highs around 31 degrees. The time now is 6:30. Now back to Your Financial Choices with our host, Lori Siebert.
Thank you, Jeff. Welcome back, folks. If you have questions, the phone number is 610-758-8810. You can talk live on air with me or off air, whatever is more convenient for you. 610-758-8810. Let me mention one other thing about the 529 accounts. You heard me say that the earnings growth income is tax-free as long as the funds are used for qualified education expenses. The next question might be, well, what if it's not used for qualified education expenses? Then it would be, if you took a distribution out of it, it would be a disqualifying distribution, and the income is going to be subject to income tax, and the income portion would also be subject to a 10% penalty if you used it for something other than qualified education expenses. So subject to tax, 10% penalty. There are some exceptions to the 10% penalty. Some of the exceptions are scholarship, military, disability, or death. So if you were someone who had a 529 for a child, grandchild, yourself perhaps, and one of these events occurred and you needed to take the money out, you still would have the income tax on the earnings, but you would can avoid the 10% penalty if you have an exception. So keep that in mind as well. I also had a question someone had asked recently about their 529 accounts for their grandchildren. They're the owners of the account, and they said, oh my gosh, we heard it's really not good to be a grandparent and own the account because it's factored differently. What does that mean? I think what happens is sometimes people get confused with what, you know, talking heads are spewing sometimes, because people like to, I think, cause drama or drum up drama to get you to pay attention and think that you need, you know, advisors or whatever. What I want to say about that is there is or could be some implications to financial aid when you're taking a distribution out of a 529 account owned by the grandparent. Let me see if I can quickly explain this. If you have a 529 account and you're the parent, or a child has a 529 account, when you go to file for your financial aid application, the FAFSA, which you can do early now, you don't have to wait till January next year. You can actually get in and file your FAFSA right now based on your prior year tax return. But when you go in to file the FAFSA and you put in your financial information and you enter that you have a 529 account, if it's the parent's account or the child's account, it counts as a parental asset. And the expected family contribution of the parents is based on, you know, their income and their assets, but the rate at which the parents' assets are included, and gosh, I haven't looked at it in a while, but I think off the top of my head, it's like 6%. If it's the child's own asset, now the 529 could be the child's, and they have allowed that that's considered a parental asset. But if a child has a savings account, a bank account, it's a much higher expected family contribution from that child. I think it's like 23% or 4%. I'm going to have to do a show on FAFSA so I can remember, but it's a much higher percent. The same thing applies then if a grandparent takes money out of a 529 account to give to the child to pay for school, that is considered a resource for the child. It doesn't make it income taxable to the child. I think there's some confusion around that. But it's a resource for the child that when they're filling out the FAFSA form, they have to count that as a resource. And that has a higher expected family contribution. So that's where some of the confusion is. So one of the things that I want people to keep in mind instead of panicking about it is, first of all, would you be eligible for any financial aid anyway? A lot of people might not be eligible for financial aid. So what difference does it make if the grandparent takes the money out of the 529? Sometimes the financial aid that the child is qualifying for is simply loans. Well, maybe the family doesn't want them to take loans anyway, as long as they've got this money in the 529s between the parents, the grandparents, whatever. There might not be any need for loans. Why take that burden on along with that interest rate? So maybe there's no need to file the financial aid application for what I would call free money or for a loan. Now, granted, some schools will base their scholarships on the information that is on the FAFSA form. So it is still sometimes a good idea to complete the FAFSA form for maybe a public college or a private school who might have some scholarship that they would offer based on the information that they find on the FAFSA. So you're not always filling it out just for aid. There might be other reasons. So go ahead and go through the process. But as far as getting any financially based, need-based grant kind of funding, if that's not going to happen anyway, I'm not, you know, I really don't think it's going to make a big difference whether grandparents take the money out of the 529 to help pay for the child's education. If the child is eligible for financial aid, maybe the grandparent is well off, but the parent is not. The parent decided to be some occupation, you know, that doesn't pay a lot. So maybe they're on hard times and they would otherwise qualify for financial aid. Well, then maybe you don't want to take money out of the grandparent's 529. So in that case, the grandparent could wait to take out the money for the senior year, because then at that point, the senior year, they've already filed all their financial aid applications, senior year of college, I mean, and then it won't matter if it's considered a resource. Or the grandparent could change the beneficiary on the 529 account as well to another family member. So there's little ways around that. Bottom line, if you plan on making 529 contributions and you're a Pennsylvania resident, know that it is a deduction. So you're not going to write the check to your child. You're going to make the contribution directly to the 529. You can own it. They can own it, whomever. As long as there's a 529, you have the child's name and the Social Security number, and you have Pennsylvania income, and you're within those limits I mentioned earlier. That's a deduction for Pennsylvania. That's a 3.07% savings right there. So that is still a pretty good rate of return right off the top for making that kind of contribution. Let's talk about education credits then. Remember I said there's something called a coordination of benefits. You can't then take a distribution out of a 529 to pay for qualified education expenses, get that great tax savings from it, and then also qualify for education credits that are out there. You have to coordinate those benefits. So this is something you want to pay attention to at year end. Let's say you had a child who had $20,000 of tuition, and you took the $20,000 out of the 529 to pay for the tuition, and then they had $5,000 of room and board, or they have an apartment on, you know, on campus, and you could have taken another $5,000 out, but you didn't, and you paid that out of pocket. what the 529 contribution can be used for as far as qualified education expenses. It can be used for room and board. So you might say, hey, I'm going to say that the money that came out of the 529 was first used for room and board and then tuition. And then that other money I had to pay out is actually going to be the tuition money, because for an American Opportunity Credit, if you have out-of-pocket expenses of $4,000 and you're within certain income limitations, you could actually get $2,500 of tax savings on a $4,000 tuition payment. So $4,000 for tuition, and you're within certain income limitations, and your child is in a four-year program, and you haven't taken this credit for more than 4 years. For 4 years, we can get an American Opportunity Credit within certain income limits. And those income limits are fairly high. Off the top of my head, I'm thinking it's around $180,000. So if you haven't had some out-of-pocket expenses, qualified education expenses, you might want to see if you're eligible for that. Make sure you have all the documentation for it. You also want to make sure that the school issues the 1098-T, which reflects the tuition that was billed for the school, because the IRS is going to be matching those up. You want to keep very careful records on this. But the last tax planning opportunity for year-end might be, maybe you didn't have those extra expenses and now you're thinking, gosh, I might have missed a year. If you pay the tuition at the end of the month, December, for next semester, you can still take that deduction, again, with subject to all the limitations and everything like that. What you want to check to see if it's worthwhile for you to make a tuition payment at year end. Quite often they're not due till the beginning of January. If you made it in December, might you still qualify for that American Opportunity Credit? As long as the tuition that you're paying now is for within the first 3 months of next year, you could get that deduction this year. When might you have that? Well, you might have that when, let's pretend you have one spouse who might be working, the other one's not, and they got a new job that they're going to start in January. Well, if they started in January of 2017 and all of a sudden you're both working and you're making $200,000, you might not qualify for that American Opportunity Credit for your sophomore next year. But you have the freshman this year, you might want to see if it makes sense for you to pay some tuition early, you know, in December for the next semester, so that you can qualify for that education credit. I also then like to point out to people, when we're talking about education credits, quite often there might be some credits or deductions out there that you don't even realize that you qualify for. And one of them, there's something called the Lifetime Learning Credit. That's for people who are beyond that four-year education. That's a great tax credit. If you spend, I think, up to $10,000, you can take a $2,000 tax credit. And when I talk about tax credits, that's a dollar-for-dollar tax savings. So it's really a great credit. But sometimes the income limitations aren't as high as we need. Maybe you make too much money and you're not going to qualify for them. There is right now something called the tuition and fees deduction, and that's a deduction on page one. And that is where you can have higher income than these other ones. I believe, I was going to see if I could find it. I'm talking about this off the top of my head. So but it's a deduction, not a tax credit. So it's not as good, but it's still something. But it's for people who might not otherwise qualify for the American Opportunity Credit or maybe even the Lifetime Learning Credit. So you might be able to take a deduction on page one. Back to my scenario of that you could pay it by the end of December, the tuition for next semester, and get this deduction. Why that would be important is because that deduction right now is scheduled to expire at the end of this year. You might not be eligible for it, or it might go away in 2017. So that would be another deduction you might want to look at to see if you would be eligible for it. And if you have tuition that maybe you're going to start school in the January. I know a lot of grad programs, sometimes students don't start in the fall. They'll start in January. So if you're someone who's going into a grad program that starts in January and you think you might qualify for this, again, run your numbers. It might be something worthwhile looking at whether or not you make a tuition payment in December to see if you can qualify for the deduction. And that's the tuition and fees deduction set to expire at the end of the year. That is not one that they extended. They still might, but as of today, they did not extend it. So we've talked about education credits. When we come back from the next break, I'm going to wrap up talking about retirement accounts and see if I can speed through some of the other tax saving strategies you might still be able to do before year end. If you have questions, there's still plenty of time. Feel awfully alone tonight. The phone number is 610-758-8810. Back in a minute.
WDIY thanks its members and Valley National Financial Advisors, offering a broad spectrum of financial services including portfolio management, tax return preparation, and financial planning for the accumulation years, retirement years, and estate distribution. On the web at valleynationalgroup.com or 610-868-9000.
American folk music offers a variegated pattern of performers and styles. I'm Tom Druckenmiller, your host for In the Tradition. Together, we'll trace the roots and branches of American folk music from the earliest recordings and performers through today's talented players. In the Tradition, Wednesday evening from 7 to 9 p.m. on WDIY 88.1 FM and WDIY.org. WDIY, Lehigh Valley's community NPR station.
And welcome back to the show. And I have a caller on line one. We have Frank. Frank, can you hear me?
Yes.
Hi, how are you?
Okay.
Good. You're like my hero calling tonight because I love when people call in and ask questions. And I get tired of hearing myself. So tell me your question.
Well, it's kind of long-winded, but let's see if we can compact it.
Okay.
So we sold a property. It was a family property in New Jersey.
Okay.
I live in Pennsylvania. We sold the property in New Jersey. It was split four ways. It wasn't an inheritance.
Okay.
We own the property, myself and three siblings,
okay.
my three sisters.
Alrighty.
And the settlement from that was about $28,000 for me.
Okay.
I put it in the bank.
Okay.
It's just sitting in the bank because I don't know what to do with it. Subsequently, the sale was done to a private person. There was another group that was involved, a development group, that reneged on the deal.
Mm-hmm.
And they were liable to us for $10,000 as a settlement for not buying the property.
Uh-huh.
We got that plus damages as well. So that's another $4,000. I stuck that in the bank. It's sitting there because I don't know exactly how to handle it. I assume these are both incomes that I have to report.
Okay.
That's what I assume. Even the settlement, there was some question about it, but it sounds like the settlement is also considered income.
Well, let me tell you a few things to pay attention to.
When there's
a sale in New Jersey, what you're going to, if you had a settlement sheet, someone you went to a settlement agent, you have a settlement sheet, the HUD statement. Quite often in New Jersey, they're going to withhold New Jersey income tax and pay that over to the state. You want to look at that settlement sheet to see if they did that, because some people miss that.
Okay.
So look at the settlement sheet. And then what happens on your own return, you will have to file a New Jersey return, I would expect, because if it wasn't a principal residence, there's no exclusion. If it wasn't inherited, what you have to look at is if you bought it or it was gifted to you. If you bought it, the cost basis is your purchase price plus adjustments for things like settlement or any improvements. If it was gifted to you from a parent, then you have inherited the parent's cost basis and their holding period. So I suspect it could be long-term, but their cost basis, you know, it depends on what they paid for it. So in your example, let's say this property ended up being sold for $150,000, and after expenses, the four of you each got $28,000. But mom or dad paid $100,000 for it, and maybe they put improvements into it, and it was worth $150 when they gave it to you guys. Then you might have a loss, and it's a personal loss, which isn't deductible. If they paid $50,000 for it, and you sold it for $150, again, for adjustments for settlement, because there's always settlement charges and things like that that are going to affect the cost basis or the your proceeds. So let's pretend, in my example, they bought it for $50, you sold it for $150, your cost basis is mom or dad's, you have a $100,000 gain between the four of you, then you have a reportable gain on New Jersey, and you have to file a non-resident tax return, but you want to look on that settlement sheet to see if there were withholdings.
Okay, I'm not sure about that, but it went through a lawyer, so okay. I'm sure they would have any kind of pertinent documents that
yeah.
we can request.
Yeah. Well,
I'm thinking.
The other thing is, the four of you might not all be Pennsylvania, might not all be New Jersey, so you want to look to see what happened there.
Well, three are in New Jersey, and I'm the one in Pennsylvania.
Okay. Well, maybe
so
not. Then.
I'm thinking this is not something that I'm going to do through TurboTax. That I'm going to have to go. Mm-hmm. With a professional preparer at this point.
Well, you would want to make sure that you use the proper cost basis would be my caution for you. So you
right.
want to know if it was a gift, what was the cost basis to the donor of the donor before they gave it to you, and were there any subsequent improvements in the property of which you would share 25% of, if there were new windows, new doors, new cupboards, renovations, landscaping.
Yeah.
That all
yeah,
adds
that,
to the cost basis.
That was done, and it was documented, and also there was a loan taken out against the property to pay for my mother's costs before she passed away.
Yeah.
Well, so all of that's been documented.
Okay. Well, that loan probably doesn't have anything to do with anything. So you just want to pay attention to those other items for cost basis that I mentioned. And you may not have a gain, but you still might have to file the New Jersey tax return, because there may or may not have been a 1099-S, S as in Sam, a 1099-S issued, which I would expect there would have been, and you will have the one-quarter piece of that 1099-S. And even though the proceeds might show, let's say, $30,000 to you, you might have netted $28,000. You would want to report in that New Jersey return sale proceeds of $30,000, cost basis of $30,000, zero gain or loss, or proceeds of $30,000, cost basis of $40,000, nothing to report.
Okay.
You
well,
know?
And then the other question I have is, since we're at the end of the year,
uh-huh.
would there be any benefit to me examining whatever taxes I may owe and trying to ameliorate that with an end-of-year gift to a not-for-profit?
That might help if you itemize deductions and you're over the, you know, if you itemize deductions and you were going to make the charitable contribution anyway, if you thought you were going to have a gain, it would help for federal purposes, but it's probably not going to help you for New Jersey purposes because you're a non-resident
okay.
in New Jersey. Okay?
Okay. But, I mean, itemizing, I don't really do, because none of my contributions up to this point have been significant enough to do that.
Right,
but,
so that's
you know,
not
this
gonna
one,
help.
This one would be one that I would establish, you know, and say, well, okay, well, maybe this year I give $3,000 or $4,000 to a single organization and see if I can't use that to
well,
ameliorate.
Well, it would only help for federal. It's not going to help you for New Jersey.
Right. Well, yeah. I didn't think so,
yeah.
but I thought maybe for federal it
yeah.
would help me.
Yeah, okay. Might help a little bit, but capital gains tax rates in for federal aren't that high, so I don't
okay.
know if I would do it just for that in this
okay.
scenario.
Well, I think I did the smart thing by putting it in the bank and not touching it.
Yep, right.
Until I figured out what the heck has happened.
Right, right. That's
okay.
a good thing. Okay, Frank, thanks for calling
right.
in. I appreciate
thanks.
It. Give me a break.
All right.
Take care. Have a good
Bye.
Night. Bye. Let me wrap up with a few items to think about before year end for tax planning. IRAs. People who have employer-provided, employer-sponsored retirement accounts and you give through your payroll, you may or may not be able to also do an IRA. There's income limitations. If both spouses work and both spouses have employer-provided plans and you're over certain limitations, you're not going to be able to do IRAs. If one spouse doesn't have an employer sponsored plan. You may be able to do a spousal IRA. There's certain limitations on that. If your income is below certain thresholds, even if you have an employer-sponsored plan, you may be able to fund IRAs. Quite often, I think sometimes the best suggestion is if you are someone who's borderline around any of these income limitations, the best advice is probably to wait until you look at your tax return, because the IRS gives us until April 15th to fund IRAs for the prior year. So I have up until April 15th to say if I want to do an IRA contribution and have it count toward 2016. That's deductible IRAs. You can do the same thing with Roth IRAs, because there's income limitations on Roth IRAs as well. Roth IRAs, we don't get a deduction for off our tax return, but any contributions to that Roth, as they grow, the earnings are tax-free as long as we have eventual qualified distributions out of the Roth IRA. The earnings are income tax-free because we didn't get a deduction for it up front. But there are income limitations on whether or not we can fund a Roth. So quite often, unless we know for sure our income is below those limitations, like on a regular basis, we might want to wait until April 15th to or doing our tax return to see if we want to fund a Roth IRA. If you know that you're able to do it every year and you always have consistent income, some people do monthly payroll withdrawals or systematic distributions out of savings accounts into Roth IRAs. You can do that kind of thing too. So you might be someone who just knows you can do them every year. So the deductible IRAs and Roth IRAs. Some people do non-deductible IRAs and convert them later to Roths. That's also another strategy. Things to think about at year end. But I might not rush to contribute to an IRA at year end if I think I might not be eligible for it. For example, my brother-in-law emailed me, "Hey, Lori, I left my former employer. I rolled my 401k into a rollover IRA. I'm now with a new employer, but they don't have a retirement account. How much more can I put into my IRA?" Well, I had to email him back and say, you may not be able to put money into an IRA, because if your prior employer marks the W-2 that you were eligible for an employer-sponsored plan, just because your current employer doesn't have one, you may not be able to put money into an IRA if you're over those income thresholds. So we have to know what the income thresholds are. We have to know if you were a participant in an employer-sponsored plan at any time during the year. You may not be able to do the deductible IRA. And again, whether or not he could do a spousal IRA depends on those limitations on page one of the return. Another thing to mention for people who might be thinking about doing IRA contributions, Roth contributions, employer and sponsored retirement contributions, if you're below certain income thresholds, you may qualify for something called the Retirement Savers Credit, which is like the government giving you money. If you're married filing joint and you're not making more than $37,000 and you put, let's say, $4,000 into an IRA, you can get a credit against your taxes of 50% of your contribution. These are some huge giveaways. It won't exceed the taxes that you owe, though. But sometimes what I've seen happen is we can do a deductible IRA such that it brings the income below certain amounts so that they get the 50% credit. It's really fabulous. So the Retirement Savers Credit might be something you do want to look at before year end. And IRAs, Roth IRAs, 401k contributions, 403b contributions all count toward that. So some people are eligible for it and they don't even realize it if their income is below those certain thresholds. For single people to get the 50% credit rate, it's $18,500 if your income's below those thresholds. So it's sometimes fun to play with those numbers. You can, there's so much more I didn't get to. I tell you what, next week I can go over the remaining items that I didn't get to tonight about doing charitable contributions or estimated tax payments. I wanted to mention, if the 2017 post-election tax provision proposals go through, many, many people next year may not have to itemize because they plan on raising the standard deduction. They're going to take away the exemptions possibly, but they're going to raise the a standard deduction. And if they do that, you may not itemize the way you used to. So you might want to accelerate some of those itemized deductions you otherwise would have benefited from. So, for example, if you're someone who pays estimated tax payments, you might want to pay your state estimated tax payment in December instead of January if you think next year you might not be itemizing. And that only makes sense if you're not subject to alternative minimum tax. So if you're not subject to alternative minimum tax and you itemize and you make estimated tax payments, you might want to think about making your fourth quarter state estimated tax payment in December. I'll touch base on a few more items next week. I will also next week talk about year-end review, reviewing your financial situation, looking at your estate planning documents, insurance, what kind of things do you want to take some time to look at to see if you need to update or make any changes? I'll do that next week and finish up our tax planning saving strategies. Coming up next, we have Tom Druckenmiller with In the Tradition Folk Music. I want to thank Lori for being here, Jeff for being here. Frank, thanks for calling. I appreciate it. Remember, pay attention, be proactive, not reactive. And make the best of your financial choices. Have a great week.